Good afternoon, and welcome to Las Vegas Weekly's radio magazine on KUNV. It is just like reading Las Vegas Weekly, only you don't have to do any of the reading. But there's also none of the sexy club photos, so it's a give and take. Anyways, my name is Rick Lax. I am a staff writer for Las Vegas Weekly, and on tonight's show, Kristen Peterson is going to look back at the history of one of Las Vegas's most controversial neighborhoods. And after that, in the second half of the program, I am going to be joined by Absinthe star Melody Sweets, and she and I are going to be talking about what it's like to be backstage at a performance of Absinthe. But first up, it is Kristen and local historian Ryan Paco Alvarez.
Hi, this is Kristen Peterson with the Las Vegas Weekly, and it's very exciting right now here in the studio because I'm with Brian Paco Alvarez, lifelong resident, a curator, urban historian, and blogger for his website, enculturatelasvegas.com. And even more exciting, we're here to talk about the Arts District. This week's cover story is on the history of the Arts District, and nobody knows it better than Paco, who's been there during all of this. He's been at nearly every event and has watched it all happen, unfold, grow, seen everything pretty much. So welcome, Paco.
Thank you, Kristen.
Now, one thing we were talking about the other day, we should just sort of start right away. Wes moved into the Arts Factory in 91, but you mentioned that Maine and Charleston had already had some things going on there.
Yeah, historically, we look at it over the last 50 years, you have Desert Art Supplies was actually on Main Street, the oldest or longest surviving art supply store in the city, a third generation today is still running the place. They moved, they're a little farther east on Charleston now. Also, there was the Las Vegas Arts League opened up their first gallery not far from the corner of Las Vegas Boulevard in Charleston at 921 Las Vegas Boulevard South. And also, the Arts Factory has had quite a little history also as far as the arts. I have a photo of a giant pencil protruding off the top of the building, and Wes had mentioned it before, and then when I saw the photo, I was like, oh, okay, I confirmed that. That's really cool. And then the Greater Las Vegas Chamber of Commerce with their Las Vegas News Bureau, the famous Las Vegas News Bureau archives, was located on the corner of 3rd and Charleston.
Well, that's pretty interesting, especially the pencil. I didn't know about the print shop there, and that's why it's great to have people like you around.
I just like going into old documents over at UNLV Special Collections or at the State Museum and going through microfilm.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, right.
So why do you think this sort of has that background, that history? I mean, we sort of think it is this industrial area full of auto shops, mechanics, whatnot. Why do you think there always has always been a creative element right there?
Well, you know, it's interesting if you look at arts districts around the country and around the world, they've always seemed to have cropped up around industrial areas where things are just run down, rents are cheap. And it was just natural for this to happen here in Las Vegas. You look at La Boca in Buenos Aires, Argentina, I mean, that was all longshoremen. That was the place where ships stopped and dropped off their cargo. And all of a sudden, now you have a vibrant arts community there. And the same thing here in Las Vegas. Not that we have ships pulling in or anything.
Yes, well, yeah. We have our own.
Yeah.
No, but they sort of like Soho. So what you're saying is sort of moving into the industrial area. Now, can you describe the scene like shortly after Wes moved in and when he started calling it the Arts Factory, the CAC was there, the Nevada Institute of Contemporary Art, or for contemporary art, I can't remember which one it is. But what was it like going down there at that time?
My earliest recollection of the Arts District was, well, actually, it goes back even to my childhood when my father's best friend had a transmission shop on Main, and we used to drop off the old Thunderbird over there to get it fixed.
Sweet.
And that's my earliest recollection. Then the Arts District, my very early recollection of the Arts District was Cafe Enigma.
Yeah,
and we were
Julie
going.
Brewer.
Yeah, Julie Brewer, may she rest in peace. She opened up that cafe, and then later Len Adams Doris came in, and we were hanging out there probably in 94, 95 in this little bungalow that was turned into a cafe. And then the Game Festival, which was the Gateway Arts and Music Experience, which happened in 97. And we started going to this yearly festival that was always behind the Arts Factory. and the city had started doing this mural program. So we started seeing the inkling of the arts beginning to happen, and it just happened right there, which was very interesting.
And the Gateway started, I think, in 98, right?
97? I thought it was 90s, somewhere around 97, 98.
Yeah, so right there in the 90s. And like you said, Cafe Enigma Cafe, that was like the place to be, mm-hmm. you know, and then that eventually closed. Now, when Gateway came along, the Game Music Festival, was there a lot of turnout? Was there a lot of interest?
At first there was, and then the last one, which was the year before First Friday started, it was pretty dead. I mean, mm-hmm. it was not the big event that they had hoped for. I remember going there, and I was part of Laser Vita at that time.
Oh yeah.
So towards wow. their kind of the last year that they survived, and we had some fun. I mean, Katie Matheson had his gallery where Sin City Gallery is today, and there were some fun times. I'll tell you, the Arts Factory was a pretty cool place. It still is to mm-hmm. hang out and to see where it came from and where we're at today in the development of the Arts District. It's really remarkable.
Was it pretty exciting back then? Did you guys realize this is something big that's happening in a city where it needed to happen?
I don't think we ever... Well, you can never predict the future. Mm-hmm. At least we envisioned things. Wes mm-hmm. always envisioned these great things. And I remember when he mentioned to me that he wanted to open up a restaurant in the space where his restaurant is right now. And it was just one big mm-hmm. empty space. And it was an art gallery, I believe, at one time. And it was cool because it had these windows in all these different directions. And then all of a sudden, he finally opened up the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And that was like a huge, big step for the area.
No, wasn't that Tanaka's Bistro that was there?
Yes.
Back in the day? And then Seat Theater was there for a while. Or Test Market.
Test Market, Seat Theater, absolutely. And there was, that's about it. I mean, the Funk House was actually, Cindy's going to be celebrating her 11th anniversary mm-hmm. this year. And she was just down the street. And it's interesting because when we talk about the very first Friday, I remember they had created this little path of orange footprints between the Arts Factory and the Funk House, and it was the space, the sidewalk. There was no sidewalk between the Arts Factory and the Funk House. Actually, Casino Center had no lights, so it was really dark.
I remember that. It was pretty dark. I don't remember the little footprints, though, so I missed out on that.
Yeah, they went, and she they did these footprints in orange, and I've been wanting to recreate that kind of. Maybe I'll do that for the 10th anniversary.
I was going to say. I mean, now they have the Atomic Passageway and some art on the streets, but somewhere they could sort of relive it.
Well, and the footprints were on the pavement because there was no sidewalk to speak of between the two spaces. So when you look at how they gentrified the street today, it mm-hmm. wasn't like that back then.
Yeah, they have all the public artwork. They have the light that was installed sort of for the RTC bus line mm-hmm. coming in, and then all the trees that were planted. But I think you should pursue the orange footprints.
I think so, too. I think I just outed myself with the city. I'll probably get arrested for graffiti.
That's fine. That's fine. I'll be there to report about it.
Great.
But so those days, I remember there were small crowds. I mean, it was a crowd, and it was, for me, it was really exciting coming from Minneapolis and not really having seen something like this take place in Las Vegas. You know, I was just sort of familiar with, you know, the sort of fragmented city and the strip mall. So I remember being really excited, even though there might have only been a couple hundred people around back then.
That's it. I think they estimated 300 people the very first Friday. And it was a lot of fun. And we all knew each other, which was great.
Yeah, and that's what I remember. It was a very small community. It was almost like a big art opening, mm-hmm. rather. And then you mentioned something I read on your blog, that back when CEC was across from the Arts Factory, it had an art opening.
Mona, Mona, Mona was yeah. their opening show in 97. And Jim Stanford told me, he said, and I quote, there must have been 1,000 people out there and the cops didn't know what to do.
Oh, that's really funny. Little did they know that there'd be 10,000, 12,000 people, you know, down the line.
Every month, yeah.
No, did you expect that? What did you think when you heard Cindy was playing this first Friday thing? Did you think, wow, this is going to take off? Or, again, just kind of going with it?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I don't even remember how I heard about it. I think maybe it was Katie Matheson mentioning mm-hmm. it to my friend Mike. And next thing you know, we went down there, and then there were all these other people or... maybe it was through Laser Vita. I think maybe it was through Laser Vita, this art troupe that I belonged to. But it was just, yeah, let's go down there. And it was kind of normal for us to go down there. And then all of a sudden it happening every month. And we were down there religiously.
And how important do you think this is to Las Vegas, to have an arts district, a place where people can congregate, where creative types can meet and show their work, and people can go there knowing that they're going to see something? I mean,
for a city like, for any community to have a vibrant downtown or to have a creative class, the development of the creative class, as Richard Florida talks about it in his book, you have to have an arts district. You have to have amenities for people to appreciate and to not just, it really comes down to economics. You know, if we're going to diversify our economy here, if we're going to tap into the creative economy, we have to have an arts district. We have to have an entertainment district. We have to have very cool neighborhoods where people can congregate. We have to have gayborhoods, as they call them, you know, where the LGBT community moves in, you know, and we need to have strong historic preservation laws that protect the old houses. And we then can demonstrate to the public, say, look, you know, Las Vegas does have a heart and soul. It's got history. It's got all these old cottages, these old homes. You know, why buy out in the suburbs when you can have a bigger lot? You have all this mature landscaping. You know, it just, you go to any city, any downtown that has a vibrant community, and you look at what's around there, and you have the cafes and the bookstores and the nice little houses, and that's what's happening downtown. It's really the importance of the arts district is seminal to the future of downtown. You can't have a vibrant downtown without an arts district.
Well, and you said something interesting about heart and soul of the area. You've always known that there was something happening here, something creative, and there was a strong community, and that there's a heart and soul in Las Vegas, to Las Vegas. Has it been hard to convince others? You know, I know everyone talks about First Friday and how it sort of brings in the suburban crowd and whatnot, but is it hard to kind of get the message across that something is going on here and has been going on here for a while?
Oh, absolutely. As an urban historian, as some people have dubbed me, you know, I look at the history of this community through both being born and raised here, but also through my research. You know, when I hear people say there's no art, no culture, no art, no history here, I can then prove it to them. Say, no, actually there is, and let me tell you why. And then I start telling them the narrative, and they're like, oh, we never thought of that. And you stump them. And it has been a struggle. And you talk to anyone who's involved in the arts district or in the cultural arts in this community, it's a constant battle to educate this community because of the transient nature of the people that live here.
No, that is true. And, you know, you mentioned struggles also. The arts district has seen its share of struggles. You know, businesses have opened and closed, galleries have come and go, and there's been a lot of drama, you know, people not always getting along, but it has survived. And, I mean, where do you see it now, and where do you see it going?
Well, today it's a vibrant neighborhood. People are clamoring to move downtown. When I moved downtown 6.5 years ago, we couldn't get people to move into my building.
That's
today,
funny.
There's a waiting list. And you know, a local magazine called this the best place to be a bohemian downtown. So I'm very excited about that. But it's interesting because I lived in my building with about 6 or 7 other people in a building that has 51 units for the first 6 months, and the building was empty. You know, and now we are at 100% capacity, and people just want to move down there. And it's mostly artists and photographers and teachers and people who work in the creative fields. A lot of the bartenders of a lot of the bars downtown actually live in my building, which is kind of funny.
That is pretty funny. You're in a great space. And then there's the condos down there. And of course, everybody likes the neighborhoods, John S. Park and Huntridge.
Sure.
But so that's pretty interesting. You moved down there 6 years ago?
6.5 years ago. I'll be going into my 7th year in 2012.
No, just the final question. We have to wrap up here in a minute. But what about the galleries and the shops and the bars that have gone in downtown? I mean, do you see it moving forward and more happening in the area?
It's picking up enormous momentum. It's amazing to see it where it was when I moved down here. And even coming down here in the early to mid 1990s with Cafe Enigma, and you know, Doña Maria's, the Mexican restaurant, was there always. And to see it today, it's like, you know, and you hear about all the projects that are happening, and you talk to the people in the city and about the upcoming projects and these plans and the high rises that are being planned and little restaurants that are going to be opening up within the next year, plus the Smith Center and all mm-hmm. the museums like the Children's Museum, the Neon Museum finally opening up, the Mob Museum. It's just, it's really amazing the momentum. We're picking up, when I hear people say, oh, the economy is bad, I'm like, well, I don't see it.
You're right, because a lot of this has been happening in the poor economy, even with things opening downtown in the Arts District.
And kudos to the mayor and to mm-hmm. the city council for really, and Betsy Fretwell, of course, to the city manager's office for really doing a stellar job. The city is great to work with. They're just an amazing team of people, and they really took a risk in investing in downtown at a time when the economy was not good.
Well, great. And as Paco says, it's only going to get better. So be sure to read about all of this in the Las Vegas Weekly and, of course, Brian Paco Alvarez's blog, enculturatelasvegas.com, where he keeps everybody updated on just about everything in the arts and in downtown that's happening. Thanks again for being here, Paco.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome back to the second half of Las Vegas Weekly's radio on KUNV. I'm Rick Lax. I am a staff writer for Las Vegas Weekly. And right now I am joined by Melody Sweets, who is the star of... there's a couple stars, but because the other stars are not here with us, we will say that you are the star of Absinthe. So congratulations on your promotion.
Well, that's fabulous. Thanks.
Hi, you're very welcome. Now, this week I came by to Absinthe and I hung out with you guys backstage. And I think a lot of our readers, our listeners are curious as to what goes on backstage at a show like Absinthe. Because on stage, you guys are having a lot of fun. But backstage, is it just as fun? Is it all business like back there? What is the mood like most nights?
Put it this way, that's why I'm in showbiz, is the backstage shenanigans.
So it is fun, is what you're saying.
It's the best. I think the show is backstage.
So the audience is really missing out when they go see the front of house performance. The real show is backstage.
Well, they're not missing out when they go see Absinthe.
Well, of course not. They're just seeing the second best show. Best show's backstage, but still the second best show. It's still the second best show in the world. It just happens that they came into the best show, which is backstage. Now, how does the backstage atmosphere of Absinthe compare to the backstage atmosphere of other shows you might have been in the past?
Well, because I share a dressing room with the host and hostess of the show, mm-hmm. it gets really crazy. They're pretty hysterical to share a dressing room with, and they keep it just a party backstage.
So what are some examples of stuff they might do to keep it a party? What stuff that sticks out in your mind?
I guess the first thing that jumps into my brain is Penny Tibbetts mm-hmm. and the Gazillionaire, and if it's too quiet in the dressing room, let's say, Penny will just blurt out some random, like, beep, beep, bop, 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 and it'll just excel from there. And she'll try to get the Gazillionaire's attention, and he'll ignore her, and then it just escalates into this dramatic scene. It's just hysterical to watch.
Now, these bleeps that you were just making, this bleeping sound, were you censoring yourself because you were on the radio, or will she actually say the word bleep?
Oh, she'll actually say, she has her own language, let's put it that way.
Okay, yeah. Do you understand the language, or does anyone understand the language except for her, or is it just kind of her own thing?
I understand most of it since we are connected at the brain.
Oh, now, what do you mean by this, you and Penny are connected? How are you guys connected?
Well, I don't know, ever since we've met, we just, you know, just bonded, and we pretty much read each other's minds, I think.
Where did you two meet?
We met at Absinthe. We did Absinthe in Australia together, and that was a couple of years ago, and it was pretty intense months together, and we just became really great friends.
And you two have other projects together outside of Absinthe, right?
Yeah, we started a band called Sisters from Another Mister.
And how is the band going?
It's pretty hysterical. Just doing really well. We have a gig coming up, I think, on November 10th at the Artifice, and we just have a lot of fun. It's sexy. It's crazy. We smash cake in people's faces and play the accordion and some drums.
And can you promise,
keyboards.
Will there be cake smashing at the next gig if some of our listeners go to it? Can you promise that there will be cake smashing, or is that just a possibility?
I guess now I'm going to have to go buy a cake, and I?
All right, it is official. So let's get back to backstage. You're talking about sharing a room with Penny and the Gazillionaire. Now, this particular room that you share, I've been in it. It's got a lot of unique stuff on the walls. What are a couple of things that someone might find on the walls of Melody Sweets' dressing room were they to go backstage at Absinthe?
Well, on my wall, I have a couple of posters. I have an 8x10 autograph. 8x10 photo of Dixie Evans, who is a legendary burlesque performer who is still alive. She's 85 years old, and she is phenomenal. What else? There's boas on the walls. There's feathers. There's photos of people's butts.
There's photos of people's, that last one, photos of people's...
I just blurted something out that I should.
Oh, no, if you said butt, I think that's okay. Steven, she can say butt, right? Yeah, we're getting a thumbs up to butt. But I just wanted to make sure I heard correctly. Photos of people's butts. Do we know who belongs to these butts, or are they mystery people's butts?
I think I've said too much. Didn't you
say that? Oh, that sounds like a yes.
This is going to be in Las Vegas Weekly.
That sounds like a yes. So you do know whose butts they are. Okay, all right. Perhaps they're Dixie Evans. Now you mentioned also there's some posters up there on your dressing room. What posters specifically does Melody Sweets look at every single night before she performs Absinthe?
Well, Tony Hernandez, who is one of the tightrope walkers, had decorated our dressing room for Penny Pibbitt's birthday, for our first season. And one of the posters that he put up on the wall, which is one of my favorites, and I'm definitely geeking out right now.
Go ahead.
Is a Star Wars poster where they are all in a band and they're rocking out in a concert. And it's one of my favorites to look at.
All right, so that's the cool poster. Now let's talk about the more embarrassing ones. What else you got up there on the walls?
There's a couple of posters of puppy dogs.
No. Let's get to the really embarrassing stuff. Come on.
I don't know what you're looking for here.
I was talking about the Fast Five poster with The Rock on it.
Oh, my God. I wish I could take that one down.
What was the story behind that one?
That's also a present from Tony Tightropes to Penny Pibbitts, and I think she had a lustful dream about him one night.
And she made the mistake of telling Tony that she had the lustful dream about The Rock.
I think so.
I'm sure an important lesson was learned there. So the backstage area, we've got this makeup room area where we've been talking about. And then there's a separate room where a lot of the acrobats do stretching before they go up on stage. Now, you are you're a singer, you're not an acrobat. So what do you do to warm up before each performance?
I drink a little tequila, I'm joking. I usually just watch the acrobats warm up, and that's enough for me, really.
All right. Who is the most serious about their warm-ups, and who is probably the least serious? Well, I guess it would be you are probably at the bottom of warming up. But who does the most warm-ups, and then who, like you, does not do a lot of warm-ups?
I think our fabulous diva, Oksana, is the most serious about her warm-ups. And that is because she is a contortionist as well.
Okay.
So she's back there. And she's always pretty serious, so I would say that. And then the least would be me.
Okay, congratulations.
I come in and I do my makeup and I get on stage.
You say you do your makeup. I picture you just always in makeup. Surely you're going to sleep and wait. Like right now, true or false, you put on makeup for this radio interview.
I definitely did.
Okay, good. Just making sure. So what is the, let's ask, what is the number one craziest thing that happened backstage at Absinthe? Number one craziest thing that you're allowed to talk about on the air?
Number one craziest thing? That's a trick question. There's a lot of crazy things. But one of the funny things that just happened, because of our new tent and our new... decorations that Caesar has taken down. Uh-huh. You can see backstage coming from the tent into our dressing room. You can see the performers going you know, to and from the tent.
Okay.
And our beautiful balloon girl, Angel Perino, had come off from backstage, and she's sitting there talking to the boys, and a couple minutes go by, and she realizes that there is a group of teenagers all flashing photos of her because she was standing outside in her pasties. I thought that was pretty funny.
First rule of cabaret performing is know when you're wearing pasties in public. That's just cabaret 101. Now you mentioned your new tent. Absinthe, you guys left Las Vegas for a while. Now you're back in action, and you do have a new tent. What is different about this tent than the previous tent?
Well, this tent is a little bigger, and as per the fire marshal's request, it is safe for a permanent structure in Las Vegas. We have decked it out just like the old tent. We've brought everything that used to be in the beer garden outside. We've brought it all in to make it for a eclectic experience for you. And you definitely walk into the tent and it feels like you are in another world, and that was what we're going for.
I think you are onto something there, because I had seen the show in the old tent, and then when I stopped by this time around, I came about a half hour, 45 minutes before show, and even at that time, a half hour, 45 minutes before show, there were a lot of people in that tent already.
Yeah. So, they've opened the doors earlier now, so instead of standing outside at the beer garden, you come inside, and they've got, you know, beer pong or champagne pong and different games that you can play, and there's a bar inside now. Everything's been moved in. So, you know, before the show is a little bit of a party. Pretty cool.
Okay, now we have time for about one or two more questions. We're talking about backstage, being backstage at Absinthe, but let's talk about being backstage at a different show. Are there any performers or shows that you've been a big fan of, and then you have gotten to go backstage at that show? And if so, what was that like?
Well, I think that most of the shows that I've been in have been my most favorite experience being backstage, because, you know, you're in it, and the craziest things that happen, they always happen last minute, and, you know, it's just an experience that you can't really relate to anybody. You can't really show anybody that without them being there. That's why I think that you got special privileges, because no one's been backstage at Absinthe, and no one really knows what's going on. And
I charmed my way in there. And the good news for everybody else listening to this is if you do want to know what it's like backstage at Absinthe, you can pick up a copy of Las Vegas Weekly and read all about it. Now, what show would you like to be backstage at? Let's say of all the Las Vegas shows, you could hang out backstage at any one show on the Strip. What would be your number one choice?
I think I'd like to hang out backstage at Zoomanity.
And why is that? Why Zoomanity?
Zoomanity, so far that I've seen, has the sexiest performers.
Okay.
And they all seem a little bit more wild than the rest of the shows that I've seen in Las Vegas.
All right, one last question. Let's say someone's listening to the interview right now. They want to see you sing. They want to see Absinthe. Where and when can they make that happen?
They can come tonight. We've got two shows, 8 and 10 p.m., and every night this week, 8 and 10 p.m. We're dark on Monday.
All right, so is it Caesar's Palace, 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and usually it's six nights a week. Is that correct?
Yep, usually it's Tuesday through Sunday. And we have two shows every night, but Wednesdays and Sundays.
Okay, well, if you've liked what you heard tonight, you want to go hear Melody sing, go ahead and see Absinthe. Melody, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed the show, and if you want to read more about what you just listened to, then you can pick up this week's issue of Las Vegas Weekly, which hits the stands today. Thanks to our guests tonight, and thanks also to our producer, Steven Zeller. And you can catch next week's Radio Magazine Thursday at 5:30 on KUNV.